Now that we've been on retreat together for a few days, the energies and memories of what was happening before the retreat usually are starting to settle down, and one is starting to get into the rhythm of the meditation. In these morning sessions, I'm emphasizing the fundamentals of the Buddhist path, and especially the fundamentals that support meditation. And we've talked about letting go, we've talked about mindfulness of the body, we've talked about contentment, we've talked about clear comprehension. And what I'd like to talk about today is the five hindrances are one of the most important of the Buddha's teachings on meditation, and the purpose of our meditation practice, really the direct purpose, the immediate purpose, is to help us abandon the five hindrances. And those hindrances, sense desire, ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness and remorse, and doubt. And so these are things that stop our mind from becoming peaceful, and particularly things that weaken our wisdom. Panya dubali karne. So I'm going to talk about the five hindrances a little bit this morning. It'll probably be too much to talk about just on one morning, so it might take a few days to go over all of them. We'll see how we go. So when we talk about the five hindrances, we are, of course, translating a Pali or Sanskritic word, and that word is nivarana. And the word hindrance is quite a reasonable translation of nivarana, but it also is missing a little bit of something about the root of it and what the metaphor is really about. One of the most common phrase in Pali associated with the five hindrances is the little phrase I just mentioned before, panya dubali karana, meaning there are things that weaken wisdom. Okay. So in what sense is a hindrance something that weakens wisdom? So just think about it. If you're walking along a path and there's something in the road of your path, a gate or some unevenness on the ground or something like that, this is a hindrance for you walking along the path. But how does that actually weaken your wisdom? It's not an obvious metaphor that something that's a hindrance should be something that weakens wisdom. So actually the root of the word nivarana goes back to a different kind of metaphor. And ultimately the metaphor is of Vritra, the dragon or the obstructor. Literally the constrictor. In the Rig Veda, the battle, as I mentioned yesterday, the battle between Indra and the dragon, Vritra, is the fundamental conflict. And of course, this as a conflict, it can have many different dimensions and many different meanings. One reading of that, which has been proposed in recent years and which I only learned about recently, and I have to say thanks to the gentleman in Hamburg who gave me a bunch of papers on this, because he came to the talk and he thought, oh, here's some things that you might be interested in, and he photocopied all these really interesting papers on the Rig Veda and so on, so that was really kind of him. And these are pointing out that the Vedic hymns, which predate Buddhism by 1,000 years or so, I mean, they're a very important object of study for understanding the Indo-European peoples and understanding especially all later forms of Indian culture. One of the things about the Vedic hymns is that they have this very kind of bright, celebratory tone to them. And the central myth of Indra breaking Ritra and releasing the waters is like a central story to them. And the proposal in these papers was that this is the reason for these things is because the Vedas were originally a set of rituals and celebrations of the new year. So that's very suitable because here we are and it's the new year. So that's nice. And so the idea here was that Ritra was symbolizing the death of winter, when all of nature becomes dark and cold and dead and lifeless, and Indra is the one who enlivens it and who overcomes, defeats the winter and brings back life. And whether that interpretation of the Rig Veda is correct or not, but I think it's an interesting perspective on it. And it gives an interesting idea of what Vritra is. Yeah? Vritra, the dragon, the constrictor. And that's the root of meaning of the word Nivarana. So it's something that brings darkness, something that obscures, something that constricts, yeah? like a serpent that's just crushing the life out of you. And so this is the kind of the root metaphor behind the word Nivarana. So when you look at this, then it makes a bit more sense of why it's something that weakens wisdom. Because if you think of the Nivarana as things that are obscuring and darkening and constricting, then it becomes more clear why they'd weaken wisdom as opposed to something that's a hindrance that you might bump into. So this is the kind of the root idea here, that the five hindrances or the five Nivarana are something which obscure the mind. They bring darkness and ignorance to the mind, clouding it and crushing the wisdom. So that's not good, is it? Right? So to overcome them, we have to bring our indriya, right? The spiritual powers and spiritual potentials, and we have to slay those dragons in our minds. Yeah? For all of those of you who love dragons, it's okay, these are purely metaphor dragons, all right? No dragons are actually hurt in this process. So, sensual desire, ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness and remorse, and doubt. So let's have a look at each one of them. Sensual desire. We want nice things. Sensual desire shapes the world that we're in. Our realm, the human realm in Buddhism, is regarded as being part of what we call the karma loka. That's the worlds of sensual desire. That means to say that it's because of our sensual desire that we make choices, that we act and choose things, and this is the fundamental force, the fundamental karma, which is driving the world that we've created, both our individual world and through the actions of many people, through the world outside, that we see outside of us. Now, obviously we can see how that works on an individual level, that we want comfort, physical comfort. We want nice food. We feel a sense of sexual attraction. We feel wanting to like avoid painful feelings to get things that are going to be stimulating and pleasurable. We like to watch movies or TV shows. We like to see beautiful sights. We like to put on perfumes or scents to stimulate the senses and all of these kinds of things. And so this whole material production in the world is there to satisfy the needs of our senses. And so it's important to notice here that this is not just something that happens. It's not just something that, you know, it's not like we're just walking along a path and we see a beautiful flower and then we say, oh, that's a lovely flower, right? That's kind of nice, right? But no, what we've done is that we've built entire factories to manufacture plastic flowers so that we can all have that beautiful flower. Yeah? And then we throw the plastic flowers in the ocean when we're done with them and get another one. So we change the whole world in order to gratify our senses. And the world that we live in is one that's been shaped according to human desires, both on an individual level and on a public level. And, of course, that's problematic in a lot of reasons. One reason is that, obviously, I don't know if you've noticed, but human desire tends to be fairly stupid and very short-term. And we are extremely easily diverted by baubles and tricks. And you can put a fresh coat of paint on something, make it look nice, and suddenly it's a new product. Oh, we have to get that new product. And we spend trillions on advertising for things, and there's just so much junk. And we have, these days you have all this intelligent advertising, right? So we have these companies like Google. They're spending billions of dollars on all of these algorithms for targeting advertising intelligently, right? I mean, this is one of their basic things that they do. And there's this whole world. We're supposed to be living in this AI world of all these artificially intelligent things. And I'm looking at it and I'm wondering, why are you still showing me ads? I'm a monk. Have you not figured this out yet, Google? I do not want that. I do not want that either. No, don't want that. No. No, I've been using the internet for how long? More than 15 years now. I have never clicked on an ad and purchased anything ever. When are you going to give up? No, the million and first ad is not going to do it for me. You're just making it worse. Seriously, right? It's crazy. These things are supposed to be intelligent. My God. I met some Google engineers in New York, and I came to the retreat I was on, and I did complain to them personally about this. I said, when are you guys going to stop targeting me? You put just a little check saying, oh, monk, give up, right? You've got to admit defeat sometime. He just laughed. That's probably just another data point, I guess. Anyway, I use an ad blocker, so I don't see most of them, but then occasionally you do. So, yeah, there's about... I do, yeah, I use Linux and I use an ad blocker and all of those things, so I don't see that many. But they still get through occasionally. So, sensual desire, right? And we're so easily led astray. And it's amazing. You think about it. You think about how the tricks that Mara uses to divert human beings, and you're like, wow, that's just like so easy. I always think that like people who work in, especially people who work in companies that make luxury goods, they must really have a lot of contempt for rich people. Like, seriously, can you imagine how stupid you have to be to pay so much money for something so stupid? Really? You know, for a handbag or a pair of shoes or some makeup or a new car or something like that, you're paying thousands of dollars for these things. They're just so ridiculous. And they make these things, they must think rich people are complete idiots. And they're obviously they haven't been proven wrong yet. Why do we do this? Why do we spend so much time accumulating so much money and spend it on such stupid things? It's just absurd. And you can see, like, of course, you know, the Buddha was not an extremist, and and having some nice things and some pleasant things is nice. We all like that. We all like it if it's a nice day and we have a nice room to sit in and a nice thing, something to eat, and some pleasant time to spend with our family and all of those things. And this is also a kind of sensual pleasure, and it's kind of natural and it's normal and it's not excessive. And as for most people, most of the time, that's what they enjoy. But there's just something about us that we have this desire that we're just going to have more and more and more. There's a classic Buddhist tale about a king called Mandahata. And King Mandahata, it's a sort of classic morality tale where he conquered one realm after another and accumulated wealth beyond imagining in the world. And eventually he wanted to conquer the heavens as well and try to attack the heavens and conquer them, because he wanted to have divine pleasures as well as human pleasures. And so you probably can guess he gets chucked out of heaven and falls down to earth penniless and having lost everything. So we want these pleasures, and at a certain point, we're basically one of two things happens. Either we consume the whole world, or we learn restraint. That's our choices. Yeah? See, what's happened in our human society is that, I mean, the human nature has not really changed, but what's changed is our capacity. So in the past, we had a relatively limited capacity to satisfy our desires. And now, because of industrial revolution and all of that stuff, we now have a much greater capacity to satisfy our desires. When I was flying out of Sydney to come and do this teaching tour, I was just getting the plane, sit next to this guy, and I'm sitting there feeling guilty because of what I'm using up so much carbon to fly across the Pacific, right? It's bad. And I'm thinking, it'd be really nice if I could get to meet Greta Thunberg. On the other hand, I'd feel really guilty about meeting her and knowing that she sailed across the Atlantic and I flew. So maybe next time I should sail. So I'm sitting there thinking, I wonder if we could do that. Is it possible? Make like a Dhamma sailing boat retreat, right? So you could get everyone together onto a boat, and then you can sail across the ocean, have a nice retreat while you're going. Would that be good? It might be nice, right? Yeah. Well, this wind. It's a sailboat. It's a sailboat. It doesn't have any fuel. It's just the wind. So you don't know how long the retreat's going to be. It depends on how the weather is, right? And anyway, so I'm sitting there thinking about that. Anyway, so I just said hi to the fellow who's sitting next to me, and, you know, what are you up to? Where are you going? He's flying with his mate to Vegas for a week. Just for a holiday. Just going to go to Vegas for a week and then come back again. Suddenly I don't feel quite so guilty. Why? I don't understand. I don't understand people, really. And so there's this choice that we have to make in our lives. Are we going to keep on just consuming more and more and having more and more, or are we going to learn restraint? And if we learn restraint, then this is a big step forward in our spiritual practice and a big step forward in our in the wisdom and the peace of mind that's got some perspective. Because ultimately it's about what matters. And sensual pleasures are not very satisfying. And, I mean, they're okay, but one of the lessons I learnt about sensual pleasures I learnt from my friend Ajahn Chandako, who took me with his mum. We went travelling when I was in Thailand, and we went to, while we were traveling from one place to another, we were waiting in some town, and Mum decided to take us to an ice cream parlour to have an ice cream sundae. So here's these two tall Western monks sitting in an ice cream parlour having an ice cream sundae. And feeling kind of awkward, but also thinking, this better be good. And then we had our ice cream sundae, and then Chandrika just looks at me and he's like, I knew these things are impermanent, but do they have to be that impermanent? So this is how they work. It's just a perpetual sort of magic trick. Yeah? So the way that magicians work is by a sleight of hand. You keep on distracting people's attention. Get someone looking one way, and meanwhile the trick is happening somewhere else. That's the same thing that's happening with sensual pleasures. Yeah? Your mind is diverted for a moment, and then you fail to see what's really happening. And it's a very powerful trick, and it's a trick people use to manipulate people. It's a trick that people use to part you from your money. It's a trick that people use to get what they want from you. And it's a very effective trick. So if you want to have some peace, and if you want to have not just some peace, but if you want to not be just a slave to your desires, then you have to learn something about restraint. Something about the power of saying no. How do you do that? How do you actually make that difference? Well, it's not as hard as you'd think. When last year we were invited for a dana for the meal at a Sri Lankan family, and this is one of the things that practices in the Buddhist tradition, so people in the families will invite you to their home. Sometimes, you know, not for anything special, but sometimes it might be for a birthday or some celebration or something like this. And this day was for the birthday of the son of the family. And he was turning, I don't know what he was, 14 or something like that. Anyway, so then he got all of these presents. He was really excited by all these presents. And so I sort of saying, oh, you know what you got? He's got that. He said, oh, okay. I said, so what's that going to look like in a year's time? He just looks at me. I said, you know that's going to break. He's like, what? No. It's the last time we invite a monk for a birthday party. But that's the thing, isn't it? Yeah, these things are fine. These things are nice. It's nice to give presents at someone's birthday, but just a small thing is enough. You don't have to make a big deal about it. It doesn't have to be really expensive or anything like that. Just something small and meaningful. Yeah, if you're going to have friends over, just it's enough to cook a simple meal and to share some delicious food with each other. It doesn't have to be a big deal. If you want to wear nice clothes, it's okay. It's all right to wear nice clothes and to want to look good, but just keep it in moderation. You don't have to have a wardrobe full of shoes. You don't have to have a garage full of, or a basement full of boxes of things that you've never opened and you've never used. You don't have to change out this year's thing add last year's thing and get this year's one just because it's this year's one. It's okay. So if we live with moderation in everything that we're doing, then it becomes much easier for us to let go of sensual desires when we're sitting in meditation. Now, the way that sensual desires manifest is very varied depending on the individual. And what your particular thing that's obsessing you or that you want or that you're interested in, that's your thing. But all of those things have something in common, and they all have in common that they are impermanent. And so just as if you go to a shop or to a shopping center, you can look at all of the things there and think, oh, well, this is impermanent. This is going to break. These clothes, these are going to tear or wear out. These electronic gadgets are going to get old and outdated and break down. All of these things they're going to pass away. And when you look at that, and you look at both sides of them, you look at the passing away of things, then it cools you down. You know, you become not so caught up in them. And the same thing then, if you get into that practice of doing that on a regular basis, the same thing happens when you're in your meditation. And the desires and the fantasies and the stories you tell yourself about the things that you want, you say, oh, that's okay, but that's also impermanent. And you keep reminding yourself, oh, that's impermanent, it's uncertain. And remind yourself, what's it like when you get that thing, the thing that you want? It's okay. It's all right. It's not the greatest thing in the world, but it's fine. And then life goes on. When I spent my first rains retreat in Thailand, I was in a place called Phujomkong, which is a very little hermitage on the Mekong River. And in that monastery, we would stay at the top of a little hill and walk down. It's about an hour's walk down to where the hall is, and then we would go for alms round in the village after that. And it's very, very beautiful countryside because it's on the top of cliffs, and so you have these like black rocks and then these which are sort of carved in these very weird formations, and then you have, you know, patches of trees, and in the rainy season creeks and streams of water will be flowing down, and the ground's covered in this like moss which becomes full of wildflowers. So you're walking down this like fairy wonderland of beautiful crystal clear water streams and carpets of like purple flowers and blue flowers and yellow flowers everywhere. And it's just amazing. One morning I was coming down, we were coming down at dawn. And so the dawn time, of course, is so beautiful. The sky is lighting up and you can just see the sun appearing over the horizon. And on this particular day, it was like a very cloudless day, very bright, clear day, and it was also full moon. So the ground is covered in flowers and streams of water, and the sun's rising on one side, and the full moon is rising on the other side. It's just so unbelievably beautiful. It's just unbelievable. Everywhere that I looked, it's like almost gobsmackingly stunning. And then I looked over the other side and there was a rainbow. I was like, no, it's too much. Nature, it's too much. I can't take it. And you can't imagine that. It's such a beautiful thing. And then you're like, okay, all right, keep going. And then a few minutes later, it's all gone. You can't imagine something so beautiful. So as long as we see all of these pleasures and these sensual experiences like that, then they're not too much of a problem. The Buddha compared the mind that has sensual desire with a bowl of water that has a dye in it, a brightly coloured dye. And so when you see it, it's beautiful. But you can't see through it. It doesn't have any clarity. So there's nothing wrong with dyed water. It's okay. It's good for some things. But you can't see through it. It's lost that clarity. So again, this idea of niwarana as, if you like, a hindrance, but also as something that obscures and hides, something that covers over reality, covers over the truth. And so as long as that desire is in your mind, you can't see the truth because everything you see is covered by your desire. It's as simple as that. And if you think that you're going to have some kind of realization or some kind of insight, but you're not able to free yourself from that desire, it doesn't happen. Everything that you see, everything that you know, will be coloured by what it is that you want. So we have to stop wanting. The good news is, of course, as I've been saying the last few days, is that because these things, because it's not just the sensual pleasures, not just the things that we enjoy that are impermanent, but it's also the desire for those things is also impermanent. So this is the good news, because it means that that desire that you have for that thing, that will come to an end, no matter what you do about it. You can't keep just wanting that thing forever. It will come to an end. So if you reflect on impermanence, you reflect on letting go, then you'll be able to see that desire fading away. Okay, so that's probably enough for today. We'll leave you to your meditation.